There is a science behind influencing people, and we're going to be talking with John Levy about that. He's a behavioral scientist, and we'll talk about his work. It's amazing how to influence people when we come back. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, John Levy with us, behavioral scientist, best known for his work in influence, human connection, decision-making. Now, John specializes in applying the latest research to transform the ways companies approach marketing, sales, consumer engagement, and culture. Now, his clients range from Fortune 500 brands like Microsoft, Google, Anheuser-Busch, InBev, you know, InBev bought out AB, Samsung, to startups. And more than a decade ago, John founded the Influencers Dinner. He's got a TED story on YouTube, which is fantastic. It's a secret dining experience for industry leaders ranging from Nobel laureates, Olympians, celebrities, executives, to artists and musicians. And they don't know what each other does until they sit down and have dinner. Welcome, John. That's a pretty novel idea.
Thank you so much. I'm really proud of the absolutely terrible meals that they've cooked me over the years.
But they all have great careers, right?
Oh, my God. It's really humbling getting to sit down with all these people. You know, when you sit down with a Nobel laureate who just made you guacamole, it's like this incredible bonding experience. But then you get to hear about their life and their journey, and it's just incredible.
How did you get involved in this field?
As a behavioral scientist?
Yeah.
The true story is that I grew up really, really unpopular. I was geeky and didn't have many friends. And back then, when in the 80s, when I was a child, when you were into technology and science, then it wasn't the cool thing to do. And so I figured maybe if I understood how people behave, I could make some friends.
Did you have pens in your pocket and all those pocket little protectors?
Oh, I wish I was that stereotypical, but I think we had kind of moved on from that by that point. I was collecting a lot of comic books, so I can tell you a lot about Thor if you want.
I bet.
Or the Avengers.
I hope you still have those comics because they're worth a lot of money right now.
I do. I have a really awesome collection. And if you want to geek out about it sometime, I'm happy to.
You know, I used to have the original Superman comics and stuff, and they're all gone. I don't know where they are.
Holy cow.
I think Mom got rid of them.
You could have retired with a fortune. Those issues are worth millions of
dollars. Oh, my God. Don't tell me that. Are they really?
It's like owning Bitcoin back in, like from 10 years ago.
When it was 2 cents a coin or something like that.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, this is a fascinating field. And let's talk about the word influence. What does that mean to you, John?
So it means the ability to have an impact on a person or an outcome. It's pretty simple. What it doesn't mean to me is taking photos of avocado toast in bikinis on Instagram. That's a really impressive skill set to be able to create content for a lot of people. But most of the things that we care about when it comes to influence is more like getting my boss to see that my ideas are good, or helping my child get into the school they want to go to. And it's much more subtle.
Or convince somebody to do something that they're opposed to doing?
Possibly. Helping them see that the opportunity or something like that. What it isn't is also power, right? It's not forcing somebody to do something, but hopefully getting them to see the opportunity or having them trust you enough that they'll see the potential of something.
Are there some people, John, who are just experts at influencing other people?
There's a whole lot, a lot of content writers. I mean, there's certain things on the internet that when you read it, you're like, oh, I need to buy this product right away. And I think that influence really comes down to a handful of factors, like who we're connected to, how much they trust us. And then there's all these kind of odd behavioral cues, like things called the halo effect or the mere exposure effect that really cause us to trust or be willing to do something more.
Does a child pick up on these techniques?
That's an interesting question. My area of research isn't around children, but I would figure so, because if you look at these, I guess a simple example would be if a kid hears about a toy from a friend, mm-hmm. then they want that toy.
That's right.
And so we all have a level of influence regardless of age.
These abilities to influence, are we born with these traits or do they develop later on in life?
So I would say that it's at the core of what it is to be human. And the reason is that most of the time we're not really thinking all the way through an idea. As George, you have an expertise, and if you say, John, oh, if you want to be popular and have a radio show, here's my advice. I would trust you because you're clearly very competent.
I've been there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so it's for human beings, it's just a great shortcut that we end up selecting people that we trust and then being guided by them. That could be your best friend, it could be your parents, or it could be some personality you know from television.
Can influencing backfire? And by that I mean, can the wrong people have that ability and they use it for certain gains?
Oh, well, absolutely. Let's look at people who are...
Like Hitler. Hitler was one.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, so he understood a lot of critical cues of giving people a sense of belonging. And for human beings, there's almost nothing more important, right? So if you think about the way we punish people, we either exile them or we put them in solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm.
And so Hitler was able to give people the sense of belonging and some image or idea. And that experience was so special to them that they would do just about anything he said, even if it was against their best interest.
Exactly. But how did he develop his trait?
That's an interesting question. I think it was probably honed over the course of a career. You know, in the early descriptions of him, I don't think people specifically said he was particularly charismatic.
Right, and had a lousy childhood, too, I think.
Yeah, and so I think that these are things, that, much like muscles, that we can develop and strengthen. And I think that he really dedicated himself and probably found a feedback loop that was really effective for him.
Well, with John Levy, his latest book is called You're Invited, The Art and Science of Cultivating Influence. Tell us about that title. It just came out too, didn't it?
Yeah, it came out on Tuesday. It's been absolutely wild. The general argument is that what we really want is to be influential, to have an impact on our life. And that is a byproduct of who we're connected to, how much they trust us, and the sense of community or belonging that we share. So if we can figure out how to be masterful at all those things, then we can have an incredible level of influence on the things that matter to us.
I live in St. Louis, and I know the Bush family that basically ended up selling the Anheuser-Busch to InBev. But they were geniuses at marketing, geniuses, influencing people to buy their beer products.
Mm-hmm.
And were those some of the things you would get involved with?
I'm more on the, like, when human relationships really matter.
Uh-huh.
So,
okay.
For example, if you are a large company, like SAP, right, big software company, and you want to connect with CEOs of the major corporations, how do you actually access somebody like that to become a client? Because they're being bombarded with requests. How do you actually develop a meaningful relationship with them if you only have a few minutes? And so I'm the person who large companies look at and say, okay, we want to either connect with our employees, top customers, and develop those relationships so that when the time comes for them to spend, you know, $20 million on software, we're the top choice.
Analyze this story for me, John. There was a guy who was a salesman, and he was pretty successful, except he could not sell to this one guy at a company. He tried and he tried and he tried. And let me set the stage for you. The guy who was the buyer of the products for this company was about 5'4", small guy in stature. The sales guy who'd been trying to sell to this guy was about 6'7". And he did everything he could to get this guy to buy his products from him, and the guy just wouldn't let him, wouldn't buy from him, didn't like him. One day he's talking to a friend of his, somebody like you, and the guy said, you need to put him above you because he's intimidated by you. He's, you know, he's 5'4". You walk in, you're 6'7". He don't want anything to do with you. You've got to flip that. So he said, what can I do? And the guy told him what to do, and this is what the guy does. He goes into the guy's office, appointment number 20, expecting, of course, to get rejected again. As he walks in, he's holding his briefcase, which is unlatched, but he's holding it together like it looks like it's latched. And he trips on purpose and falls. He goes splat on the floor, opens the briefcase, papers go flying. The little guy gets out from his desk and picks up the 6'7" guy and helps him up on his feet. The guy sits down and he thanks him for that. But he made the position with the guy. He made the guy feel a little more important than the guy who fell. He felt comfortable. He got the sale that day. What did he do right?
So human beings have this weird characteristic called the pratfall effect. And if you've ever watched, let's say, a romantic comedy, you'll notice that the lead character is falling all over themselves. And oddly, we like them more for it. And so researchers did an experiment almost identical to your story. They had people go in for job interviews. And group one just went in and did the interview. Group two went in and either spilled a bit of coffee on themselves by accident or made it look like an accident, or they dropped a pile of papers. And here's what's really interesting. We rated those people as more likable and higher for the interview. And that's because when we show a bit of vulnerability, people actually like us more.
Yeah.
That 6'7" guy probably exemplified everything that was intimidating and quote unquote the perfect model of what a person mm-hmm. should be.
Probably everything negative that happened to this other guy, what he was in school and everything else,
mm-hmm.
just magnified it every time he saw this guy.
And so there's this interesting thing about how trust actually exists or is built, and it's called a vulnerability loop. And so we think that trust precedes vulnerability, but it doesn't. The way it works is, let's say, George, the two of us were walking down the street, and I said, it's been a really tough week. I'm really overwhelmed. I've just signaled vulnerability.
Right.
Now, if you make fun of me or ignore me, then trust will be reduced. But if you say, John, it's been a really stressful week for me too, what's going on with you? Then you've signaled vulnerability, and we've completed the loop, demonstrating that we're safe with each other, and trust is increased. When the man fell, the salesman fell, and dropped his papers, he demonstrated vulnerability. When the customer stood up and supported him, they completed the loop, and trust was increased.
The guy who told him what to do was brilliant.
Oh, this is such a great strategy.
And it worked, and I guess the guy stayed friends with the other guy, and he kept his sales, and mm-hmm. everything worked like that.
So it's similar to the famous example for Benjamin Franklin. It's called the Ben Franklin effect, which is that Franklin had a political rival who was risking Franklin's position, and instead of being nice to the guy to try to win him over, he asked to borrow a rare book from the man's book collection, which required him to go far out of his way to bring it to Franklin. And from that point on, they ended up being friends until their passing. And that's what's kind of interesting, is that we expect that if I do nice things for you, you'll like me more. But if I actually want you to like me, I should ask for favors and find ways for you to invest effort into our relationship.
John Levy with us, his book, You're Invited. John, tell us about these dinners that you put together and the concept behind it.
So I started off by inviting 12 strangers to come to my home, but there's a twist. they're not allowed to talk about what they do or even give their last name.
How'd you even get them to the house?
So the first ones I invited were just people I kind of knew. They weren't as impressive as they were later on.
Okay.
And so they'd come over. We'd cook dinner together. And then when we sit down to eat, everybody gets to guess what everybody else does.
That's part of the routine.
Yeah, it's like a fun game. It's to turn it into something playful and see how good you are at figuring other people out. And the truth is, we're just terrible at it.
And other than you, nobody knew who everybody was.
Nowadays, I don't even know.
Okay, all right.
Because I like the game as well. I like having fun with it. And then there's this big reveal. One by one, we end up finding out that it's, you know, Nobel laurate Dan Kahneman and an 8-time Olympic medalist. And
it's like a takeoff of the TV show, What's My Line?
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. And so by the end, you find out that you're with Grammy winners, Olympians, astrophysicists, anything and everything you could imagine. In fact, several of your former guests, Seth Shadrach.
Oh, yeah. SETI.
Yeah, which is such a brilliant guy.
What a super guy he is, isn't he?
Oh, and like charming and fun. And I think he was on the Dating Game 5 times. And like, just like a fun person, right? We end up then just hanging out and getting to know each other. But what's interesting to me about it is that everybody thinks it's the dinner that makes it special. It's actually, the dinner's terrible food. We had a famous journalist come, and she said, I was expecting phenomenal food and decent company. I got the exact opposite. So it's just like, it's terrible. You could go to like Chipotle or, you know, some fast casual restaurant and get better food. But because we cooked together, because we had those vulnerability loops happen while we were cooking, then it bonds people in a much deeper way, and they end up becoming friends in the process.
Yeah, I was going to say, do they stay in touch with each other after?
Oh, it's incredible. I hear stories about people launching companies together. Or
really?
Oh, yeah, and journalists doing features about other, yes. One of the wildest things, literally, I could have never imagined this when I started the dinners. I introduced a person who's on the Nobel Committee to Patch Adams.
I've met him at a couple conferences.
And he got a Nobel Prize nomination as a byproduct of that introduction.
How about that?
And I was blown away. I mean, Patch does incredible work for healing people. And
his work with children is amazing.
Yeah. And so it's one of these odd privileges. I personally don't consider myself, you know, I'm not particularly famous or I definitely don't have a Nobel Prize or anything like that. But it's really such a privilege to be able to introduce these people.
What have you learned with this kind of procedure?
The biggest thing I learned is how much all of us really want to have great friends. It's pretty shocking how isolated a lot of us feel. And we have this impression.
Especially now.
Oh, my God, yes. It's, when going back as far as 1985, the average American had 3 friends besides family, but 3 close friends. By 2004, that was down to 2. So in less than a generation, we lost a third of our close friends. And what really concerns me about this is that, first of all, it's not social media and things like that back then. It was people moving.
Hold on for a second, John. We're at a break. We'll come back and pick it up right there in just a moment. We're going to take your calls next hour with John Levy as we talk about influencing. Tell us your techniques and what you've come across. Maybe you have a story or two you can share with us as well. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you with John Levy, his book, You're Invited, The Art and Science of Cultivating Influence. Boy, once you learn the science of this as an individual, you can do some amazing things, John.
It's pretty amazing, first of all, how backwards we have a lot of the ways that we interact with people. And as I was exploring this book, I found out that everything from the way that we were building trust to the way that we were connecting with strangers we kind of do backwards, and it's limiting our ability to build the relationships that really matter to us.
I think one of the reasons for that is, you know, as we grow up, our parents, God love them all, they try to do the best job they can, but a lot of people don't understand the mechanics behind what you work and what you do.
Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is that we're constantly also discovering new things. The great example is that up until basically the year 2000, economists said, okay, everybody's a logical human being. And then the great Nobel laureate, Dan Kahneman, said, that doesn't actually make any sense. We're highly emotional and we make terrible decisions. And that really opened up the field completely for us.
There are some people who in professions trust certain people and then they don't trust other people. Why is that?
So it turns out that we always say that trust is the most important factor in a relationship, but we never explore what trust is made of. And it turns out that researchers generally agree it's made of three things. The first is competence. You have an ability to do the job that people expect of you. The second is honesty or integrity. You're truthful. And then the third is benevolence, that we have other people's best interests at heart. Now, what's interesting is they're not all equally valued, right? So if I watch an old basketball game and Jordan missed a shot, then I wouldn't say, oh, Michael Jordan can't be trusted. He's incompetent because he missed that shot. We're pretty okay with people messing up occasionally. But if you found out somebody lied to you, you would begin to doubt everything they said and everything they say moving forward. That's a serious breach of trust. But there's a weird loophole, and it works like this, George. If the two of us are walking down the street and I say, hey, I forgot something at a friend's house. Do you mind if we stop by really quick?
Mm-hmm.
You're like, yeah, of course, no problem. And then when we enter, 40 of your closest friends jump out and scream, surprise.
Yeah.
It would be really strange if you turned to me and said, John, you just lied to me. We can't be friends anymore.
Right, exactly.
And that's because I did it for benevolent reasons.
I mean, I would say, John, you got me.
Yeah, exactly.
Something like that.
And so human beings value benevolence above honesty and honesty above competence. And so when you look at the people that we trust the least in our society, which is used car salesmen, you don't think that they're honest or, more importantly, benevolent. You don't think that they have your best interests at heart. Meanwhile, when you look at the most trusted people, they're nurses, and you assume that they have competence because they have to pass a series of exams. We assume they're honest because there's no reason for them to lie to us. And we assume also that they're benevolent because who would go into nursing if they didn't actually care about people?
If you had a car salesman who built up trust with people, I bet that person would do very well.
Yeah. There's actually, I think it's Dan Pink's book, To Sell as Human, he talks about top car salesmen that have incredible levels of integrity and how successful they become. Because once you know you can trust a person like that, then you begin telling your friends and then it spreads from there.
I mean, I'd love to see a salesman say, you don't want that one and this one's better for you and it's less expensive.
So that's exactly it. It's funny because we say, oh, we don't want to be sold. I think we actually kind of do want to be sold. We just want to be sold by somebody who cares for us.
Right.
Because, like, I want your advice on what you think is great. I want my best friend's advice on what they think is great.
Absolutely. That's human nature, isn't it?
Yeah. It's how we survived as a species, is that we came together and we shared knowledge, often probably over a fire or while we were collecting berries or hunting for something. And that's what's kept us alive, is our ability to interact and share knowledge.
John Levy with us, his book, You're Invited. Where do you get the book, by the way, John? Just came out.
You can get it everywhere from Amazon and Barnes & Noble, Books A Million. You can also get Kindle or Audible if you prefer, or audiobooks.
What would you like people to take away from the book if they read it?
So I think the biggest thing is that the fundamental element that defines the quality of our lives is the people we surround ourselves with and the conversations that we have with them. And no matter how shy or introverted or even lonely we might be, there are a lot of people who'd love to get to know us. And if we're willing to build that muscle a little, we can have incredible relationships that can have a profound impact on our life or the things that we care about.
You say that trust is built on three major things: competence, honesty, and benevolence. Tell me about those three. Let's start with competence.
So as I said, competence is your ability to do a job. Honesty is how truthful you are. And benevolence is that you have people's best interests at heart. Much like how we talked about the car salesman being non-benevolent. Then we didn't trust them, and the nurse, benevolent, we do.
Can an influencer succeed if they're bad communicators?
Oh, interesting. I think that's it would be tough, but it's very much possible, kind of like you gave this beautiful example of the salesperson who dropped all their papers. Because we tend to like people who are more vulnerable, it depends on how they express it. So you could be bad at communicating, but we could be really rooting for you. And so the fact that you stumble a bit and aren't perfect in your communication may actually cause us to pay more attention and want to support you.
Why do people tend to like people who are humble as opposed to braggadocious?
Oh, that's interesting. So I would argue that it's non-threatening, right? So if I find you, like, not you, but if a person is braggadocious or pompous, it doesn't demonstrate any of that vulnerability that allows me to feel like I can connect with them.
I mean, I've seen some people in events and things like that, that they're just loud and boisterous and braggadocious, and nobody wants to be around them.
Yeah, or if they do, it's probably because they're incredibly wealthy and they're trying to get something from them.
So
you can buy company, you just can't really buy friends.
We're in a situation right now, John, with COVID, that a lot of people, it's getting a little better. But, a few months ago, it was a difficult situation for a lot of people. Suicides were high. Anxiety levels were high. There was a story here in Beverly Hills, California, of a guy whose grandfather left him millions, I mean millions of dollars. The guy jumped out of his high-rise building because he didn't have a lot of friends because of COVID. I don't get that.
It's pretty incredible how painful isolation and loneliness is. So there's kind of two important factors here. The first is that the greatest predictor of human longevity isn't like the latest hot, kale cleanse or meditating every day.
Mm-hmm.
The greatest predictor after genetics, number two, is having close friends and family. The number one is social integration, feeling like you're part of a community. And research by Matt Lieberman found that when you're experiencing or a person's experiencing social pain, in brain scans, it looks identical to physical pain. And in fact, when he ran experiments, he had people take either placebo or painkillers. And when they experienced social pain, those that had Tylenol or painkillers didn't feel that social pain. Pain is pain. Now, we're used to thinking about it as, I broke a bone, that's painful. Or if somebody hit me, they should go to jail. But what we don't tend to think about it is as somebody said something really hurtful to me, or I feel a major loss of a loved one, and that's pain. But it turns out that pain is just pain. And so we will go to really far lengths to escape that kind of pain.
Can you make an unhappy person happy?
There's definitely things that they can do, and there's new therapies that come out all the time. if somebody's very much dedicated to being unhappy, they'll find a way maintain their unhappiness. But I think that there's a lot that we can do, and there's phenomenal techniques out there.
Who are some of your best psychologists who have looked at this subject as well, past, present?
So there's a famous researcher by the name of Dan Gilbert who studies happiness research specifically. And some of the craziest research that's come out is a study done on lottery winners and people who got into accidents and became quadriplegics and paraplegics. And what they did was they tracked their happiness levels in general and like daily happiness levels, and found that after 6 months, lottery winners were less happy with day-to-day activities than the quadriplegics.
Interesting.
And that's a crazy thing. It means that most of the things that we try and pursue probably won't necessarily have a great impact on our happiness. And with the lottery winners, the issue is that once they won all that money, how do you recreate that sudden joy? You can't. It was completely random. And to add to it, all of their friends and family started coming to them for money. And so it socially isolated them. Meanwhile, the people who got into the accident, day by day, they learned to improve their life. They became more mobile. They felt that they had more facility and control. And so those improvements actually let them feel better about themselves.
Are people who are so-called successful, and I don't know how you gauge that, but mm-hmm. are they better influencers than those who are not successful?
Oh, that's interesting. So there's this wild study done by Christakis and Fowler that looked at the obesity epidemic. And they found that if you have a friend who's obese, your chances of obesity increase by 45%.
Right.
But what's really weird is that your friends who don't know them have a 20% increased chance, and their friends have a 5% increased chance. And this kind of effect is true for happiness, marriage and divorce rates, smoking habits, voting habits. So we can have an incredible level of influence just being around somebody who's not quote-unquote successful. And it could have a very negative impact, or it could even have a positive impact. So I think the question is, what are we trying to affect?
That's amazing work. And like you say, you're a behavioral scientist. There's a science behind this, isn't there?
Oh, without a doubt. We did actually a really amusing study, me and my lab partner, Dr. Moran Cerf, who's a neuroscientist. And we looked at, it was probably the largest study in history on dating. And we were curious what actually gets two people to date. We looked at 421 million potential matches between people. I know you have a dating app.
Yeah, Paranormal Date.
Yep. And here's what's really, when I heard about it, I was like, oh, I love this. This is so cool. And the reason is that opposites do not attract. The research that we did showed it person by person. But what does attract is the more familiar people are with each other. Right. So if we went to the same type of school, we were more likely to date. If we had the same religion, we were more likely to date. And the craziest thing, this went down to our initials. If people have the same initials, they're 11.3% more likely to date.
You're kidding.
Yeah, it's called implicit egotism. Anything that reminds us of ourselves is more attractive and appealing.
That's interesting.
And so your dating site, I think, is awesome, because it actually fulfills on something very specific. It's people who have shared interests, who value the same things. And frankly, that's what's going to lead to a more likely to a connection and a longer lasting relationship.
So when you deal with a company, mm-hmm. what do they want? What are they looking for?
So they want to deal with two things, generally. It's either internal company culture, right? How do we give people a sense of belonging? It turns out that you can track a company's stock value, employee sick days, and profitability down to the level of trust at the company. And so if we can increase trust, then people are going to like their coworkers more, want to work harder, and also will be less likely to leave and work at another company. The other area is, how do we connect meaningfully with our customers? How do we get in touch maybe with those executives that we need to, or the people who are really influential in the industry that are opinion makers? And when relationships really matter, that's when I get the call.
We're going to come back in just a moment, John, and take some phone calls for you next hour here on Coast to Coast. The name of the book, You're Invited, The Art and Science of Cultivating Influence. Phone lines are open, so get ready to make the call, and we'll get you on as soon as we can as we continue chatting about influencing. Share your stories, too, beyond just a question for John Levy, if you've used these techniques before and how they may have worked for you. So we'll be back in a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. Don't touch your dial.